New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. This week, there was some resolution in the case of so-called serial infector David Kwiatkowski, the Exeter hospital worker charged with infecting more than 30 patients with hepatitis C. Kwiatkowski was arrested last summer, and what made the allegations against him even more chilling was that he'd apparently transmitted his disease to other patients in other states for years before he was caught in New Hampshire. In a federal courthouse in Concord, Kwiatkowski admitted to all 16 charges against him. And as his case was heard, his victims outside the courthouse sent a message to the man inside.
Hey, David, you remember my face when I was laying in bed and I asked you why your eyes and you were sweating? You remember my face, buddy. 40 years.
That was one infected patient who identified himself to WMUR News as John Doe. Under a plea agreement, Kwiatkowski will serve 30 to 40 years in prison with final sentencing in December. But even as this chapter closes, the Hep C story is not over. The U.S. attorney said his investigation remains active and ongoing. This case made for enormous headlines this week, but there were many others that we'll cover today on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, including the resurgence of expanded gambling, the Senate President, Peter Bragdon, taking a controversial, high-profile new job, and how trouble at AOL could affect local news gathering here in the Granite State. Let's get you into our news roundup, too. Your questions and comments about these headlines and others that caught your attention this week. Give us a call, the exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org, and you can also post a comment on our Facebook page. With us in studio, Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for the Telegraph of Nashua. And Kevin, I know you're a busy guy. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civics scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back and thank you as well.
Good morning, Laura.
And gentlemen, I want to start with the hepatitis C story because that was huge this week. With us now for more on that is Todd Bookman, NHPR's health reporter. And Todd, thank you also for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
So one big piece of this story, Todd, was resolved this week, as I said, with David Kwiatkowski pleading guilty. Just remind us very quickly, if you could, Todd, how he did it, how he infected more than 30 patients at Exeter Hospital.
So David Kwiatkowski was a traveling medical technician. He worked on basically short-term contracts at hospitals around the country, assisting in various procedures. He arrived at Exeter in the spring of 2011 and was working inside their cardiac catheterization lab. There, he was able to access fentanyl, a powerful pain medication. Basically, he would swipe syringes, replace them with other syringes that he had already used on himself. He would refill them with a saline solution. So those were then used on patients during these procedures. And he wound up transferring hepatitis C to at least 32 patients inside of Exeter Hospital.
Yeah, so he was a drug addict, basically.
He was, and he admitted that in court, and he said he'd struggled with both alcohol and drug addiction for quite some time.
Well, what was so frustrating and just so awful about this story, Todd, was not only the people in New Hampshire, but then it turned out that he'd worked in many other places and caused trouble there, which made a lot of folks wonder, why didn't the alarm bells go off sooner?
Yeah, so the plea agreement released Monday by the U.S. prosecutor said it gave a lot more details on just how long that this had been going on for. Kwiatkowski trained as a health worker in Michigan and admitted that as far back as 2002, he started stealing controlled substances. He was fired four times in 4 years.
Wow.
Just in Michigan alone. He was always able, though, to find work at the next hospital, then as a traveler. He was caught numerous times inside of various facilities. There was an incident in Arizona where he was found to be passed out in a hospital bathroom with a syringe. He simply left Arizona and was able to land another job at another hospital through this temp agency. So in total, it was about eight states, nearly two dozen hospitals over this 10-year period. It isn't clear when he first contracted hepatitis C, but the first patient tested positive back in 2008. And since then, at least 45 patients across the country now have matching strains of the virus.
Oh, it's so chilling, and it really does make you wonder about background checks.
Right, and whether references were being checked and how he was able to sort of skirt around from hospital to hospital.
Well, as you've reported this week, Todd, this guilty plea and sentencing later later this year is only part of the story. The U.S. attorney said, quote, our investigation is open and ongoing. So it isn't just about David Kwiatkowski. What's next?
Right. So Kwiatkowski will be back in December for his sentencing. He's facing a term of between 30 and 40 years. Victims will have a chance to speak at that hearing. U.S. Attorney John Kakavas said Wednesday he is still looking into other entities for possible charges. The state health department, they put out a report about a month ago that accused an Exeter Hospital employee, a former Exeter Hospital employee that Kwiatkowski actually lived with for a period of time, of potentially helping him secure these drugs. She was cleared by the State Board of Nursing, but that could be someone Kakavas is looking into. Exeter and some of the other hospitals, too, could be under the microscope for what they knew and when they knew it.
Well, I've got a couple more questions for you, Todd, but I also want to remind our listeners that this is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're taking your questions and comments about a variety of stories. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And one more question on this hepatitis C story. And actually, Kevin Landergan, I want to bring you into this, too, because you've covered the legislature for so long. Lawmakers have been talking about this, too, having some of the same feelings that I just expressed. You know, wow, aren't we looking into these people?
Yeah, certainly the legislators around the Exeter area immediately became very concerned about this case and started looking into the legislative construct, if you will, what kind of regulations occur here. Well, as a practical matter, there aren't any. And these medical technicians who, as Todd pointed out, are primarily hired by national temp agencies that then farm them out to these various hospitals where there are openings, they're not licensed, they're not certified in New Hampshire at all. So there's certainly a pretty vigorous effort now proceeding in the legislature to propose a bill for 2014 that would either license or certify them. There's some disagreement right now about what's the proper regulation, and also to set up what would essentially be a database for all these medical technicians and temporary healthcare workers.
A national database.
Right. So you'd set up a state program where all these people would be registered, licensed or certified, and then you would network with any other state that also has its own registry or database. The missing link is this national registry. None exists, and certainly I think it's quite possible momentum could build in Congress to have a national registry, because obviously that would provide comfort to every single state about every single temporary worker who comes into New Hampshire to help out or anywhere else.
That's a huge deal. Final thoughts on this story, Todd, and then I have another one I'll ask you about.
Well, I think we heard from a number of the victims that they're not necessarily satisfied with this 30 to 40 year term. A lot of them had pushed for something longer. They wanted to see, some said life, some said the death penalty. Obviously, that was not in the cards given the 16 federal charges he was facing. I think what we saw here in the deal, though, was a look to Colorado, which had a very similar experience. A hospital worker there, a low-level hospital worker named Kristen Parker, admitted to basically the same crime, drug diversion, transferring hepatitis C to again, a roughly similar number of people. And she wound up also a plea, and she was given 30 years. And so I think prosecutors looked at that case as a guide for how long Mr. Kwiatkowski should spend behind bars.
Well, now that I've got you in studio, Todd, I do want to ask you about another health headline. The state has been talking for a long time, years really, about something called Medicaid Managed Care. And there was finally some movement on this a few days ago and a few weeks ago. The pieces are starting to fall into place here. Just very briefly, Todd, remind us what this is and why it's important.
So New Hampshire is really one of the last states in the country to try managed care. In effect, we've hired three private out-of-state companies to effectively take over Medicaid. Those companies will get paid a fixed amount per person to manage the health care of the roughly 130,000 or 140,000 Medicaid recipients. Lawmakers say this model will save the state $15 million each year, roughly. But the program is already a year behind schedule. And there's the reason it's behind schedule is because the managed care companies, they actually had to go out and sign contracts with all the doctors and hospitals around the state. But remember, the hospitals aren't very happy with current Medicaid rates, and they were very concerned that this new system was actually going to pay them less. So this summer, we finally saw, after some pressure from lawmakers, we saw Dartmouth-Hitchcock get on board. So then the hospitals joined this managed care network. And then now the last piece of the puzzle fell into place. This was the mental health centers. So the contracts are all now negotiated. There's what's called a network adequacy, so that Medicaid patients won't have to travel too far to see their doctors, nurse practitioners, to get the care they need. So now we're ready to launch. Managed care goes live December 1st. There's a lot of work to do between now and then, but after well over a year of delay, December 1st looks like the go date.
Well, and we've got Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas coming on next week, so we'll dig into that a lot more with him. But Todd, you can't say the word Medicaid without asking about the Affordable Care Act, and as you've been covering, there have been weekly hearings at the State House on this question of whether the state should or should not expand Medicaid as envisioned by the Affordable Care Act. We did a whole program on this earlier this week. A little more than 20 states have said yes, they will. A little more than 20 states have said no, they won't. How does this Medicaid managed care thing, you know, something sort of seemingly very technical, fit into this big debate over Obamacare?
So actually, what's interesting is that when these contracts were written between the state and these three companies, expansion was still mandatory under the Affordable Care Act, and it was the Supreme Court ruling that changed that. So officials, though, say, you know, that expansion could be a lot easier to implement with managed care in place. But if the state chooses not to expand, it's very much unclear if the state will actually have to renegotiate the contracts with these managed care companies. I think, though, at the end of the day, this issue about managed care and the contracts, I don't think this is going to be the issue that sways lawmakers one way or the other about Medicaid expansion.
Wow, real interesting. Kevin, you want to jump in there?
I just wanted to say that, as Todd really alluded to, the prospect of expansion of Medicaid had everything to do with why the hospitals and mental health centers eventually came to the table and said, we can make a deal, because they see at least 50,000 new customers under the expansion. So even as you're kind of sharpening the pencil, trying to save money, you're still getting more customers into the door.
So they're operating under that assumption.
Correct.
That Medicaid will be expanded.
Right. And I think it's precisely why this all came together, that the prospects for expansion right now certainly look more favorable than they might have looked 4 or 5 months ago.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you very much, Todd, for your time. Lots of good stuff to follow up on.
Thank you.
NHPR's Todd Bookman. Again, he's our health reporter. Coming up, we'll look at some more headlines, including New Hampshire's Senate President Peter Bragdon's new job, which has created some controversy. We'll look at that. Also, the revival of gambling in the Granite State. All that's coming up.
And this is The Exchange on NHPR. It's 9:19. Good morning. I'm David Darman. NHPR reaches listeners all over New Hampshire. If you own or operate a business, you can get your message to the entire state by simply becoming an NHPR underwriter. Visit the support page at nhpr.org to find out more about our many underwriting opportunities. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Clean Yield Asset Management, Norwich, Vermont, tailoring client portfolios for financial performance and social impact, including investments in local agriculture, and the Barnstormers Theater in Tamworth, presenting Agatha Christie's thriller murder mystery, The Unexpected Guest, August 20th through the 24th. Tickets at barnstormerstheater.org. This is NHPR. It's 9:20.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're looking at some of the top headlines of the week, including New Hampshire Senate President Peter Bragdon's new job, why that's created some controversy. A couple minutes ago, we also talked with NHPR's Todd Bookman about the Exeter hospital worker charged with infecting patients with hepatitis C. He pled guilty this week, and we've been looking at that. Other headlines that we'll cover this hour include the revival of yet again gambling and Concord City Council's decision this week to postpone a vote on whether to acquire an armored vehicle called a Bearcat. All that and more we're talking about on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we'd love your thoughts on these stories and more. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Dean Spiliotis, so let's talk about one of the top political stories of this week, and that is Peter Bragdon's new job. He'll head a group called the LGC, the Local Government Center. First of all, just very briefly, Dean, explain what the LGC is, and then we'll get into why some people think Peter Bragdon should not be the head of it.
Sure. It's based in Concord. It operates public risk pools that provide insurance coverage to New Hampshire municipalities. So essentially, it's an insurer of local governments. It's the state's largest insurer, about $500 million. And it has a history of being at odds, at least in recent years, with the Bureau of Securities Regulation. There was an administrative order in 2012 that said that the LGC was lacking transparency, that it needed to reorganize, that it needed to return surplus funds to members. That is now in the courts being appealed to the state Supreme Court. So that particular case has not been resolved yet. The longtime head of the LGC, Maura Carroll, was replaced by George Bald, who people know from other work in state government. He was in for about 6 months. I think he started in February. And he's now being replaced by Peter Bragdon on a one-year contract.
He was appointed on an interim basis.
In fact, he was interim. Peter Bragdon's been appointed. It's a $180,000 one-year contract. And the concern has been about a conflict of interest. He's the president of the state Senate. The president controls the agenda, controls committee appointments, controls which bills are considered in the Senate, also has a hand in the budget, actually a pretty significant hand in the budget that controls the funding for the regulation authority that we're talking about, the Bureau of Security Regulation. So the question is whether or not this is a conflict of interest. The LGC also does some lobbying as well. So
Under the New Hampshire Municipal Association, right? Exactly, yes.
So the entity itself is essentially an insurer. It's private. It's not part of the state government. So the question is, can he both be Senate president, which he points out is a volunteer position that pays $125 and a year, and head of the LGC? And we've heard a lot from local news organizations and particularly Democrats, that this is a potentially dangerous conflict of interest.
Well, and you're right, Dean, when this news first came out on Monday, Democrats jumped on it, said there's a conflict of interest, he shouldn't do it. But Kevin Landergan, now it seems like some Republicans are also saying, look, Peter, don't do this. And in all these comments, it's not personal. I mean, Peter Bragdon gets high marks for being able to work with people, being an effective lawmaker, for his integrity. But people on both sides of the aisle now, Kevin, seem to be saying he shouldn't do this.
Yeah, well, certainly the Republicans who have voiced some concern about this dual relationship really are outside the state Senate. That's important to note. Right now, there's sort of almost been a dome of silence over the Senate since this happened with regard to the Republican caucus.
In the Senate, right
now.
In
the Senate itself. So I think many Republican senators are trying to get their arms around this whole situation. Some I've learned some had no knowledge of it whatsoever until he actually called them on the day he accepted the job. So his ability to remain in both positions, of course, has everything to do whether he has the full confidence and faith of the 13 Republicans who are the narrow majority in the Senate. If he loses their confidence, he can't remain a Senate president.
Well, Kathy Marchocki and the union leader talked to former Senate Majority Leader Robert Clegg, right, of Hudson, a Republican. She also talked to Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis, again, former Republican, and both encouraged Bragdon to pick one or the other.
Right. I think one of the this certainly came as such a shocking announcement. Certainly, we all knew that George Ball was going to be replaced by someone. And given all the problems that the LGC, frankly, had had with state regulators, many had assumed that they'd actually choose a chief executive to run these risk pools who's actually an insurance company expert, someone who would give a lot of confidence to the health of the risk pools, which, by the way, are pretty healthy, but also someone who had a lot of knowledge about the industry and would be able to navigate LGC through this very tortured time now. It's important to note, you know, as Dean alluded to, that the LGC has appealed to the state Supreme Court earlier this week, the decision of the hearing officer requiring that to be returned $50 million. And that's really one of the reasons why the conflicts are present for Peter Bragdon, which is to say, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the state, then the LGC financially and structurally is in a world of trouble and may need the New Hampshire legislature to bail it out.
I see. Dean.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think Kevin is right. There had been an assumption that there would be some kind of national search and they would bring in an insurance executive. Peter Bragdon, I think, has had a couple years of experience in the insurance industry, but that's sort of not his primary driver. It's been interesting kind of watching the politics of this. Democrats are kind of sort of carefully floating this narrative that, George Bald was kind of moving the agency towards reform and transparency, and now this is kind of sort of an inside deal to sort of back away from that. They've made some freedom of information requests to get kind of the correspondence and emails between the players in the appointment of Bragdon, because it did come as a little bit of a surprise. And I think Kevin is also right that part of the problem here is that this has been a troubled agency for 7 years, a very high-profile troubled agency. And, the Senate president is also a very high-profile position. And if the Supreme Court does, in fact, rule in favor, as Kevin suggested, that's going to sort of further increase the potential conflicts for him. So, yes.
And one more narrative, though.
Yes.
And you started to pick up on this, Dean, so I'd love to ask you a little bit more. And this is from Senator Bragdon's point of view. Look, New Hampshire lawmakers are paid $100 a year. The president, I think, gets $125, Dean, as you said. So,
and mileage.
Yeah. So these folks have to work.
Right.
I mean, so his point has been, and others have made this point too, look, these folks have to work. There are conflicts of interest that come up all the time in our citizen legislature. And if it really doesn't look good, I'll just recuse myself.
Right. That is the other narrative. And that's exactly the case that he's made, that because we have a volunteer legislature and people are often privately employed elsewhere, the potential for conflict of interest arises in a way that is not the case with professional politicians, where maybe occasionally a spouse will have a relationship to an entity or maybe some investments or something like that, where this is actually, people are working outside of government on a regular basis because it is volunteer. But, the Senate president is a particularly important position with the budgetary considerations for the Bureau of Securities Regulation, the ability to control the agenda and make appointments to committees. So it's a little bit different than your sort of rank and file legislator. But his point is well taken as well.
Okay, Kevin, last thought on this, and then we'll move on.
I was just going to say that one of the distinctions here about this position is what you just hit upon, Laura, which is this is not a private business. This is a quasi-public entity that even with the health risk, the risk pools that manage health insurance, property insurance, liability insurance, workers' compensation insurance for cities and towns, they're all taking essentially public dollars from those communities in order to manage those risk pools. The very entity was created by state legislation. We've had Senate presidents in the past who've owned sporting goods stores, who've run nursery businesses, run car mechanic businesses. But we haven't had anybody, certainly in the recent past, running a branch of the state legislature, overseeing a group with this much public money involved in it.
All right. Well, again, the number for you to join us on our New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We want your questions, comments, thoughts on some of the top stories of the week that caught your attention. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And gentlemen, in a couple minutes, I do want to ask you about the revival of gambling, expanded gambling again in the legislature. But first, I want to turn to Manchester and a story that made state headlines there this week, a tragedy in Manchester, raising questions about parental rights, about security. With us now for more on that is Lynn Tuohy. She's a reporter for the Associated Press, and she covered this story. And Lynn Tuohy, just to go over the details, a 9-year-old boy whose dad had visitation rights at the Manchester YWCA was shot dead by his father, who then took his own life. A terrible, terrible story. How is it, Lynn, that a nonprofit like the YWCA gets involved in visitation issues with family issues like this?
Well, there are only, Laura, a handful of centers around the state that do this kind of work. The visitations are supervised because either a court fears that one parent is going to say inappropriate things to the child or because there's a threat of violence, as there was in this case. This story actually begins 16 months earlier when the father, Menahem Savion, told the mother, and this is according to a court finding, I have snapped. We live in New Hampshire. I have a gun. It's going to be either you for me and Joshua.
Wow.
And as we saw Sunday, he shot his son multiple times during the visitation and then turned the gun on himself.
Wow. So lots of warnings that something like this might happen. As I understand, the mom had a restraining order against the dad. So it makes you wonder, Lynn, how could this happen given that there were red flags all over the place?
Well, it's a good question. It still hasn't been answered. The YWCA does have a metal detecting wand, and the mother, according to her lawyer, David Bailenson, was under the impression it would always be used on Savion. It was not used that Sunday. There's videotape to substantiate that. Why it wasn't used, I think the Y still has to answer some questions about that. I know these centers try to make, and I've talked to several experts who work in them or refer people to them, they try very much to create a comfortable, inviting atmosphere for the parents. You know, they're involved in a highly contentious situation. So in this case, mom drops off 9-year-old Josh. Dad enters from a different entrance. And when the mom returns, the building is, you know, lined with crime scene tape and the SWAT team's going in.
Oh, it's terrible.
And her worst fears were realized.
Right. And I have a 9-year-old, so it just breaks my heart. When someone makes a threat like this man made, Lynn, and as you said, it was documented and so forth, why does he even still have visitation rights?
And that's a question a lot of people are asking. And some people think the system might need to be changed. I think you're probably going to see in the wake of this tragic incident a flurry of legislation. You know, the family courts are in a very difficult position of trying to balance the best interests of the child. The child had a good relationship with his father, and the mother even felt the value of the father, you know, seeing the child. She encouraged, according to the lawyer, good relationship, apparently did not speak ill of the father, unlike the father did of her. And, a lot of people are saying why, our first interest, the best interest of the child is protecting the child's safety. And in this case, it's very difficult to foresee something like this. Half our homicides in New Hampshire historically are domestic violence linked.
Yeah. Wow. Well, is the Y liable in an instance like this, Lynn, or is it too early to even say? I mean, this is very new.
Well, I did ask David Bailenson that question, and he said, look, we are grieving. We're not even thinking along those lines right now. It's very difficult to say. This is unprecedented in New Hampshire.
Okay. Lynn, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
That's Lynn Tuohy, again, reporter for the Associated Press, covering a story in Manchester that has raised questions about what parental rights are, also security when it comes to visitation situations like this. We invite your questions and comments on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, again, 1-800-892-6477. And Kevin Landrigan, Dean Spiliotis, another local story that became statewide, in fact, Dean, even national news, took place this week in Concord. The city council decided to postpone a vote on whether to acquire an armored vehicle called a Bearcat. We did a whole show on this last week, Dean. What were some of the issues here?
It's a very interesting story, and I remember when it first popped up in the Concord Monitor, I believe. This is sort of a small story on a city police department trying to replace a 30-year-old armored vehicle with a newer version. But it really has turned into quite a story. And I remember last week I said I would be watching the August 12th city council vote to approve the Bearcat. So the problem is that when they put in this application for a $260,000 federal grant, in the text of the grant, they mentioned by name several organizations, the Free Staters, Occupy New Hampshire, basically it suggests that the implication that came out of it was that this Bearcat, this armored vehicle, could be used for, suppressing nonviolent protests, maybe to break up an encampment or something like that. So the city council had this August 12th meeting in order to vote on it. And it turned into a bit of a circus. There were, several hundred protesters. It turned out to be a great platform for the Free Staters outside, chanting, playing drums, talking to the press. And after about 4 hours, around 11 p.m. or so, they had to postpone it because they just had run out of time. So the city manager and the police chief, have resubmitted the application. They've taken that language out. They've been assured by the granting agency that they'll still get the money. But the question is now, has this become such a political football? And this is the kind of thing that with social media and kind of sort of libertarian strain of, you know, individual rights and kind of the other interesting thing is that the hearing became the sort of broader discussion of the militarization of police,
which is a national
issue. Spending too much money on law enforcement. You know, do we really need all these SWAT teams? That kind of stuff. So I always love when these kind of when I see a story, just a little story in the news, and try to think about where it might end up a few months later, and we seem to be headed in that direction.
Yeah. So, Kevin, is this really about the Bearcat itself? As Chief Duval has said, it's basically replacing an older one, a 30-year-old armored vehicle called a Peacekeeper. Or is it that Chief Duval made the mistake of naming a few groups as potential troublemakers in his application, and he said, "Yeah, I made a mistake," and yes, as Dean said, the application has been resubmitted. So, is it really about the vehicle, or is it more about these groups being included?
Well, I really think
initially.
I really think it is about both. To be sure, Dean's right. If the chief hadn't made this mistake and referred to these individual groups, there wouldn't have been hundreds of people outside Concord City Hall this week. But there's a pretty raging debate throughout the country about the use of a lot of this surplus military equipment and what is to be done with it. And what's interesting is just from a political point of view, it kind of unites some very strange bedfellows, because on one hand you have the Tea Party, Free Staters, Libertarians, anti-government spending, anti-government expansion. But then on the other you have progressives, liberals, who are very nervous about the militarization of police and who don't want local police taking military positions. It's important also to point out, as you did in the show last week, that the chief says this tank, if you will not be armed with weapons. It's really an attempt to essentially suppress a very delicate situation.
Yeah, he said it would be a rescue vehicle.
Right.
Right, yeah. And again, this is an issue going on nationally as we see the military winding down from two wars, so there's a lot of extra equipment. Department of Homeland Security made a lot of grants over the last decade. We heard from Manchester Police, though, when we did our program. And, Kevin, they said, hey, our community loves the Bearcat. Makes them feel good that the department has the tools it needs.
I think, obviously, as we see, and I think we see this across the country, it's on a case-by-case basis. Can that vehicle be comfortable in the culture of that community? We're going to find out next month whether Concord fits that bill.
All right. Lots more to talk about, gentlemen, after a short break. And we'll take your calls, too, your questions and comments about some of the headlines we're covering this hour. 1-800-892-6477.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm show, the Justice Department sues to block the merger of American Airlines and U.S. Airways. And then the Muslim Brotherhood pledges to bring down military rule as Egypt's death toll climbs. All coming up on the Diane Rehm show.
The Diane Rehm show from 10 until noon this morning on NHPR. And support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and from Antioch University New England's MBA in Sustainability, focused on the triple bottom line of people, planet, and profit, offering part-time, full-time, or weekend options. AntiochNE.edu. And Golf and Ski Warehouse, with stores in Hudson, Greenland, and West Lebanon, New Hampshire, and also in Scarborough, Maine. Online at golfandskiwarehouse.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and we're covering some of the big headlines of the week. We've talked about the Exeter hospital worker charged with infecting patients with hepatitis C, how he pled guilty this week. We've also looked at Senate President Peter Bragdon taking a new job at the local government center. And we've looked at a fatal shooting at a YWCA in Manchester, raising questions about parental rights, how far they should extend, security arrangements, lots of other topics, too, on our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. And we'd love your thoughts and questions. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And, gentlemen, let's go to the phones. And Scott's joining us from Keene. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking the call. I appreciate the program. I'm involved in a similar custody situation. My ex-wife has some mental health problems and hasn't been allowed to see the children for about 2 years. But if she does complete some mental health programs, she will be able to see them in a supervised setting at a facility run by a local nonprofit over here.
Wow.
And one of the concerns that I've had over the years is that even if they use a metal detector, is the facility equipped to disarm a person if they discovered a weapon? My concern, as horrible as this situation with Mr. Savant and his son was, I can only think that it would have actually been worse if they used the metal detector, because that would have rapidly escalated into a hostage situation.
Mm, he might have objected to them trying to take his weapon and maybe even taken some other people.
My concern isn't that, they shouldn't be using the metal detector.
Sure.
It's that if they're going to use the metal detector, they need to also have the adequate training and capabilities to actually disarm the person and protect the staff in the organization. I'm not convinced that an organization like the YWCA or the local, family services agencies in various communities around the state actually have adequate training and resources to do that.
Yeah. Scott, listen.
I would like to see this. I'm a libertarian. I hate to suggest the government does anything, but I would like to suggest that this type of visitation center should only be run out of either county courthouses, sheriff's departments, somewhere where there is a trained police presence.
Good luck with your situation, first of all. Let me just say that. That's a tough one. And certainly he's listening, Dean Spiliotis, to that last segment with Lynn Tuohy very carefully.
Yeah, very interesting. And and he points out an interesting argument that essentially, if it was just some worker at the Y or a counselor doing the wanding, it very easily could have been overpowered. You could have had a hostage situation. Certainly a fair point to make. I think that as the director of the YWCA has said, it comes down to money and resources, that they had on occasion hired police officers when they had the available funds. If you don't have the funds, you can't hire the police officers. You know, there are a couple other red flags. We have not really had an explanation yet for why he was not wanded, even though he had been in the past. Scott's sort of insight to that potential situation aside. And the other thing that kind of struck me as interesting is the director said, these threats are very common. It's the nature of the beast when you do supervised visits that people make threats like this all the time. And, if that's the case, then you really probably have to have no exceptions in your security situation. So it's a very sad situation. I think there's going to be probably some lawsuits in the future in terms of liability. It's just very, very tragic. But the people on the other end are simply going to say, give us the resources and we can set up a situation that will be safer. But there is this tension between, a home like having a nice environment and having a safe environment that, sort of a family environment versus kind of a courthouse or a sheriff's office. But it's very sad.
Well, Scott, thank you for joining us with your own story. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-NHPR. Kevin Landrigan, I have to ask you very briefly about another Statehouse story. Expanded gambling, kind of like the fabled phoenix, Kevin. It keeps dying and rising from the ashes. Real quick, please, what happened with gambling this week?
Well, the first meeting of this Gambling Regulatory Oversight Authority took place. And their charge is really before you try and pass legislation legalizing a casino, let's put in place a regulatory system that would actually oversee one if one ever became legal.
So that was the concern that some lawmakers had, that there's not a good regulatory structure in place. How can we vote for this?
Correct. And there was a lot of discussion in the House of Representatives prior to killing that casino bill about trying to amend that casino bill and put a regulatory structure there. They never got that far because the committee recommended the bill be killed. The House agreed with that recommendation. So this, for Governor Maggie Hassan, who obviously still wants a casino and thinks one high-end, highly regulated casino would be a stable source of revenue for the state, this is the next step they need to take in order to build any momentum to somehow to get the House to approve a casino.
Although, Dean, there seemed to be some confusion on the commission about what the next step would be. Some people said, let's put the regulations in place for a potential, possible, not here, casino. Mm-hmm. And other people said, let's talk about how many tables we should have. So.
Right. And the Attorney General, Joe Foster, pointed out that he sees those as sort of two separate issues, that the danger in going down the road of talking about the number of slots or the number of table games or what the license fee should be or what the tax burden should be, that really is a policy matter, not a regulatory matter. So he suggested that they focus on the latter, which is kind of the broader regulatory framework, and hold off getting into the weeds in terms of specific decisions about policy. You know, I mean, this is an interesting argument. We've talked about this a number of times, and the question is whether or not kind of the opposing sides in gambling are kind of set in stone, or as Maggie Hassan hopes, if you set up the regulatory framework, that may win some people over. People
just
would express,
enough.
Yeah, that there are things you can tweak in the legislation or set up a better context for the legislation that will buy her some more votes. I'm not sure that this is going to be sufficient, but we know that Lou D'Alessandro is going to introduce another gambling bill, so we're going to go through this again.
All right. Well, give us plenty to talk about, won't it? Again, the number for you to join our conversation with your thoughts on some of these news items we're covering, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Kevin, another story, yet another story that was a national story but has lots of local implications here in New Hampshire. The head of AOL this week had some pretty grim news for people who work at the hundreds and hundreds of Patch News websites around the country. Now, just in case people haven't heard of Patch, Kevin, just remind us what it is, what hole it seeks to patch.
Right. Yeah, it's an appropriate name to be sure. Certainly with the decline of the establishment media, whether it's print, broadcast, radio, what have you, across the country, AOL came up with this kind of website news service that essentially is very hyper-local, as they call it. They're set up in a community where they identify a market exists and there's interest in strictly local news about what's going on in that town or that city. But as a practical matter, as we heard from the presidency of the AOL earlier this week, almost half of these sites have been economically non-performing, translation, losing money, and not small amounts of money, large amounts of money.
Really? Wow.
AOL made a major investment in personnel and resources to set this thing up, and they're now essentially acknowledging that something's got to happen to about 400 non-performing sites. There are 13 such sites in New Hampshire. About a dozen people are employed here. They do really cover a niche. And as a reporter for a daily newspaper and at the State House, I make use of Patch on a regular basis. If something is going on politically, I'm not able to get there. They often post videos of that event, and I watch that as I'm doing research on my own first story.
Yeah, so I checked out the Concord Patch this morning and the Bedford Patch just to see what was going on there, Dean. And I didn't see any word about this shakeup at AOL and this desire to shut down some Patch websites.
Right, they haven't. I think everyone's kind of waiting to see what the outcome is going to be. AOL bought Patch, the concept, for about $7 million. They've pumped well over $100 million into it at this point.
$100 million?
Yeah, wow. Yeah, I think something like $70 million just in the first year or so to get it up and running. And it's an interesting concept that, you know, I mean, part of the problem with the web is, you know, you have this proliferation of news sites all kind of running the same essential national news. So the idea was one way to be profitable is to have these hyper-local sites where it's the only place you can find news about Hooksett or Concord or Bow on the web. And not only that, make it a community. Have volunteer bloggers, kind of make it sort of a portal for sort of civic life and politics in these different communities. And it's just very difficult. As someone who's been blogging for a number of years now, it's just very difficult to sort of, you know, generate that traffic on a regular basis. One of the complaints was that the patches were kind of resorting to this sort of, you know, kind of sensationalistic crime stories and sort of rehashing quick bites and videos from other stories just to kind of keep the track, you know, because you become sort of obsessed with keeping your traffic numbers up rather than having the ability to do kind of good, solid reporting. So I've heard that concern from a number of people. So
where does the money come from then? Is the idea that if we're hyper-local, we'll get local businesses?
Right, exactly. So it sort of, you get buy-in from kind of the local community. So, you know, you can, you know, your your Concord's website, and you can see advertisements from sort of Concord outlets, and have a sense of what's going on in the community in terms of festivals and events, and it's a way, restaurants or whatever, it's a way to kind of generate interest in a particular geographical area. And some of these have been pretty effective in some of the big cities and individual neighborhoods or parts of the cities. It's a nice portal, but it just, as Kevin said, it's about 400 out of 900 sites that have been identified as problematic. So I think there's going to be some sort of shakeup here.
So no word yet on New Hampshire, Kevin?
No, there isn't.
On our colleague Dan Tuohy, who works for New Hampshire Patch.
Right. He's one of the regional editors. So,
and a great reporter.
Absolutely, he is.
And Kevin and I talk to these Patch folks all the time because they really do have their kind of ear to the ground.
And even establishment media has learned from Patch over the years as well in terms of trying to better market its purposing of hyper-local news. That's why you have the Insider and the Concord Monitor every week. That is just about what's locally going on. We have we call it Neighbors for the Telegraph that comes out on Monday. It's one of the most popular sections in the entire newspaper, and all it has is a lot of the local happenings and has columnists as well who contribute to it.
All right. Well, gentlemen, we often save our elections and politics news for the end of this show, since these elections are still far away, 2014 I'm talking about. Dean Smith noticed Jim Rubens running more and more like a candidate. Now, we've talked about Mr. Rubens before, but just remind us, give us a little bio there.
Sure. Jim Rubens is from Aetna, which is right part of Hanover, essentially. He's been a long time kind of political activist, Politico policy person in the state. He served two terms in the New Hampshire State Senate from 1994 to 98, where he chaired Public Affairs and Education Committee. More recently, he's best known for involvement in environmental causes like climate change, and as the head of the anti-gambling coalition this last time around. So he's very very involved in anti-gambling. It's interesting because he uses the word conservative a lot, but he often kind of self-describes himself as a moderate. So, there are a lot of aspects of his kind of positioning on the economy, on the budget, on jobs, et cetera, on environment, that might make him appealing to sort of a kind of a broad cross-section of Republicans and independents in the state. The question is going to be whether or not he can get through a Republican primary. We're still sort of the field is still kind of taking shape. Karen Testerman from Cornerstone, founder, had mentioned she might be getting in, and Jeb Bradley's been mentioned a few times, but Rubens seems to be the only one really operating as kind of an established exploratory candidate. Jean Shaheen has already raised over $2 million. She's going to be very difficult to beat. I think he knows that. But he's someone with a long political history in the state.
Yeah, and we've already started getting emails from him, Kevin, right? So he's up and running to some extent.
Yeah, he's very serious. And certainly, in some respects, this is deja vu all over again. I mean, he ran for governor in 1998. Right. He lost narrowly in a primary to an establishment Republican candidate, Jay Lucas, who actually went on to lose very badly to Governor Shaheen at the time for re-election. And I know many supporters of Rubens always thought back then that Rubens would have run a stronger campaign, would have appealed to moderates and independents that Jay Lucas wasn't able to. So he's certainly taken up the cudgel again now, 15 years later.
Well, and Kevin, I couldn't help but notice the top of the email says Jim Rubens, U.S. Senate. And there's a nice little picture in New Hampshire there. The bottom of the email says paid for by Jim Rubens for a U.S. Senate exploratory committee. So put the two together for me. The top of the email says, yes, I'm running, and the bottom of the email says, maybe I'm running.
Well, you said under Federal Election Commission law, you set up these exploratory committees that allows you to raise money for the purpose of a future candidacy. That's the stage he's in right now. And as you note right at the top of that website, there are blocks to contribute and donate to the Jim Rubens Exploratory Committee. So he's not made a final decision. I think certainly whether he's able to raise the money will factor in to that decision. But I've very rarely seen in my experience with Jim Rubens, I should say, over almost 20 years, to see him walk away from a challenge or something he was interested in. He's a very motivated, extremely active person.
Very passionate.
My sense is, he seems like he's from listening to him, seems like he's going to get in.
Yeah.
I want to ask you one more question about a beloved southwestern New Hampshire Kevin politician, a beloved figure on Keene's political scene, passed away this week, Mike Blastos. Wow, I'm from Keene. I remember Mike Blastos. It's hard to believe he's gone.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, he was the mayor for 8 years, longer than any other mayor in Keene, a city councilor for 32 years. It would have been 81 next month. As you point out, a very revered figure. I'm interested in full disclosure. I'm a 1979 graduate of Keene State College. I was editor of the college newspaper, the Equinox, back then. He was very much a larger-than-life figure who was ubiquitous on the campus while he was mayor. He was always around. He always went to freshman orientation.
He went to freshman orientation, really?
Right.
As the mayor of Keene.
As the mayor of Keene, to welcome the students to the community. This was really kind of a quintessential man-of-the-people politician. And by that, I mean he often rankled a lot of people in the political establishment, even in Keene. But he remained immensely popular in the community. And a lot of that had to do with the businesses he ran. He ran what was called the pub restaurant. That was his biggest business back in the late 70s. And of course, the drinking age was 18 back then, not 21 as it is now.
Are you saying you went there, Kevin?
I frequented the pub. As virtually...
Training to be a journalist.
Right. As did anybody who had interest in politics, because Mike would be there and regale us all with stories about his war horse activities in Keene.
Well, rest in peace, Mike Blastos. And real quickly, Dean Spiliotis, what are you going to be watching next week? I know it's vacation time for you, but still.
I'll be watching. Thank God for the internet. Two big political visits. Thursday, the 22nd, Vice President Joe Biden's coming to a fundraiser for Maggie Hassan. And then on Friday, the 23rd, Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz, a Tea Party freshman, is going to be up here headlining a state GOP fundraiser. So some big political activity going on in mid-August.
That is big. And Joe Biden, by the way, he's going to be in Maine,
Jim Demers, a Democratic activist, is hosting the fundraiser at his house, but it's for Governor Hassan.
And Ted Cruz coming again, an up-and-coming name
in
Republican
busy,
politics.
Yep.
Okay, well, guys, thank you very much. And Dean, have a great vacation next week. I'm sorry
you won't
be here.
See you in 2 weeks.
That's Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Kevin, really nice to see you. Thank you.
Have a great weekend, Laura.
Kevin Landrigan, longtime political reporter for The Telegraph of Nashua. We say goodbye today to the best-dressed intern on The Exchange, Tim Camerato. Tim, good luck at college this year.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with a look at libraries. In an age of e-books and internet research, we'll find out how these community institutions are surviving and thriving. Then we get the lowdown on the supermarket shakeup in New England, with some stores closing while others expand. And later we sit down with New Hampshire's Commissioner of Health and Human Services, Nick Tumpas. Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.